Welcome to Season 2 of Sea Salt and Parm. I'm Michaela from The Millennial Outside, a teller of stories, a lover of food, a wanderer of wild places, and a wearer of many hats. This is me sharing the simple things in life that I find extraordinary. Can I tell you a story? I, like any stereotypical millennial, value experiences over things every day. Give me a breathtaking mountaintop, or an incredible meal, or a wander through foreign streets any day, over jewelry, or cars, or even homeownership, as nice as my own backyard does sound from inside my closet in my 700-square-foot apartment. But for being someone so obsessed with moments, I've become incredibly bad at being present in them. I wasn't planning on taking a hiatus from podcasting, but at some point this past spring, I realized something needed to give. Like many of us at the dawn of the one-year mark of the global pandemic, I was seriously relating with the New York Times coin state of languishing. If you didn't read the viral article, I'll link it in the episode notes, but basically, languishing is a state of stagnation and emptiness. Burnout. If you're listening to this podcast, chances are you're familiar with my abundant ideas, this obviously being one of them. Since childhood, I've been a dreamer and a schemer. I'd cold email literary agents with excerpts of the stories I was writing. I'd come up with elaborate fundraisers to save my favorite endangered animal of the week. I'd rope the neighbor kids into performing plays I'd penned at block parties. I wasn't always great at follow-through. I'm still not, but the ideas were always there. Fast forward to adulthood, and I've abandoned half a dozen blogs, tried to be an influencer, led outdoor groups, made greeting cards, tried to be a photographer, written for half a dozen small publications, and dozens of other side projects that may or may not ever see the light of day. This spring, I was working on this podcast, which I totally promised myself was just for fun, I swear. Freelance writing, blogging, Instagramming, trying to write every day, working on another side hustle, etc., on top of my full-time job. I was spending more time stressing about not doing the things I thought I wanted to be doing than actually doing them, and I wasn't enjoying any of them one bit. So I set everything down for a while. I haven't blogged or podcasted or written stories or side hustled in months. Other than journaling or Instagram posts as I feel like it, writing this is the first creative thing I've done in ages. The first year I went to see you, I was living up in Boulder while my now husband, my friends, and my family were all living an hour south. I was homesick and prioritized seeing them every weekend. I was taking a full load of classes, working 25 hours a week, and getting all my homework done Monday through Friday so that I could have my weekends with my people. That taught me a very important lesson in protecting my time. I've brought it to every job I've ever had. I've always proudly worked not a minute over my 40 hours, kept my weekends and evenings free, and religiously kept work email off my phone. I've stood up for myself to bosses who told me I couldn't succeed without putting in extra hours, and I've been promoted in every job I've had since those Boulder days by setting boundaries and, of course, working hard inside those boundaries. When the fresh college grads making intro-level salaries would brag about spending their weekends working in the kitchen on Monday mornings, I'd lecture them about not letting work consume them, not giving their all to the man, capital M. To be honest, I was very smug about this lifestyle choice of mine until I set my plates down, took a step back, and realized that while I was excellent at setting boundaries with others, I'd been doing exactly what I had chastised them about, except maybe it was even worse because there was nobody to answer to but myself. As a kid, especially as a homeschooled kid with hours upon hours of endless free time, it was easy to chase every butterfly idea that fluttered its way through my thoughts. Maybe it's the workaholic culture of Americans bleeding into millennials monetizing their passions, but I got seriously sucked into the side hustle. I was filling every moment with side projects, or, more often, stressing about feeling like I should do this or that or the other, that I never stopped to think about the present. My passion projects aren't the only place I fail at being present. I'm always planning new trips, down to looking at cheap flight alerts en route to our next destination. Even if we've spent Saturday climbing mountains, I'll mope around the house thinking about all the things we could be doing on Sunday. A lethal case of wanderlust mixed with FOMO. When I set all of my plates down, when I took a break and gave myself permission to rest, it was a weird feeling. Like shaking out a limb that had fallen asleep, it was both wholly strange and nice in a way that made me wonder what I'd ever done without feeling in that appendage. Because we live in a 700-square-foot apartment without a yard, the only real outdoor space we can claim as our own is a dusty patio that overlooks a construction access road, which is not that pleasant to hang out on. So So when I want time outside, I cross the street to my own secret garden. There's a Federal Records building across the way from us that gets zero traffic. It's surrounded by a tall metal fence and some berms dotted with trees to conceal it from view. Between the berm and the fence is a long, flat spot shaded by pines and a maple or two. It's carpeted with soft grass and hidden from view of the sidewalk. Nobody goes back there except for the birds and the bunnies, and sometimes us. During the height of lockdown, we'd go out there and use it like our own backyard. We'd bring cheese and wine and a speaker and pretend we were on our canceled trip to France. Or we'd hang our hammocks between the strongest of the trees and the fence and read. One day, this spring, I went out there with a blanket and a journal, and once my pen stopped moving, I laid back and watched the clouds morph and change across the sky. I watched the shadows of the leaves as the breeze shook the branches, dappling the sunlight. I watched a tiny green aphid crawl up a blade of grass, its tip serrated from a past mow, and realized how much I'd missed doing nothing. As kids, my sister and I's school days weren't packed to the brim. We'd do a few hours of schoolwork and then have the rest of the day to do whatever we fancied. Long, stretching afternoons looming until our public school friends got home from soccer practice and could play. When I wasn't reading or writing or playing imaginary games with my sister, I'd just wander the backyard. It was my own little wilderness. I'd watch the leaky faucet fill up an indentation in the red dirt path when the sprinkler was on and paint designs with my fingers on the rocks, the terracotta-colored water seeping into the smooth cobblestones. I'd pick the longest blades of grass from the lawn and painstakingly tie them into tiny bundles. I'd watch the sunlight filter through the aspens and float leaves on our pond and watch our rabbits' noses wiggle as they munched on the grass and just be in my own little slice of nature. Sometimes our adventures would take us to the fields at the end of the block where we'd marvel at the way a sun-baked sheet of prairie clay would crack into a million mosaic pieces, or watch the black-eyed Susans bob as a thunderstorm blew in. At some point in my teenage years, I remember a distinct shift from those simple, joy-filled moments. I'd find myself in the middle of something that filled my heart with joy, wishing the moment would never end, already nostalgic for something that wasn't even over. Yanked from being present by the future. Being present is obviously easier as a kid. The future is so far away, it's not even real. The past is so short, it barely registers. Time feels longer. There's really no place for our minds to be other than the present. I wrote an article a while back on snowshoe hares and climate change. Historically, these giant-footed bunnies turn white in the winters, and then in the spring, when the snow melts away, they turn back to brown. The trigger for their color change isn't the snow coverage, though. It's the length of the days. So, as climate change brings earlier and earlier springs to Montana and Canada, the snow's melting before the days get long, the hares become sitting ducks for predators as their white fur has them dressed for the wrong occasion on summer brown slopes. I wondered if they realized they were living through a crisis. Did they gossip in passing, furtively discussing these unprecedented times? I doubt it. They've begun to adapt slowly, but I doubt they spent any significant time reminiscing about past winters or worrying about future springs. Nature doesn't care about time in the same way we do. She doesn't care about Instagram likes or side hustles or miles logged. She doesn't care about wars or elections or protests. I'm not even sure she cares about us. The sun rises and sets. The rivers flow. The tides come in and out. Plants grow, even through the concrete. As I've struggled to figure out how to be present, I bought a collection of Mary Oliver poems to read out in my little corner of the universe. You've probably heard The Summer Day. Or at least the last line. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? To be honest, I always sort of hated that line. It felt like a condescending friend of your parents asking why you don't have kids yet or what your 10-year plans are. But then I read the rest of the poem. Miss Oliver's estate doesn't allow recordings of her writing, so I'll link the poem in the episode notes. But essentially, the rest of the poem narrates a day spent wandering through the fields feeding a grasshopper. Most of Mary Oliver's poems are like this, reflections on nature, wonderings at where humans fit in. I think if anyone had being present dialed, it was Oliver. I interviewed a Muckleshoot scholar, Valerie Segrest, for another article recently, and she had a similar reflection. The Muckleshoot harvest camas plants in Washington each year, and when the flowers bloom and it's time to harvest, she mused to me, where else in the world could she possibly be but there? Like Segrest, Mary Oliver muses, what else should she possibly have been doing but this? I absolutely haven't figured out how to be present. My creative hiatus helped, a bit, but it didn't fix me. I think it's a process, a skill, a daily practice to work towards. Less shoulds help. Less time on the internet, more time in nature. When I do succeed, though, these moments feel extraordinary, important in a way not many other things feel. Maybe not more, but different for sure. One afternoon, I was sitting on my blanket in my secret garden, paging through Mary Oliver, watching the clouds. They were a little dark. Normally, I would have gone inside as the wind picked up, but I decided to stay. I watched the leaves blow around violently, listened as the birds called from the safety of the innermost boughs of a spruce. A few raindrops hit me. I watched as the storm passed and the sun came out, and I went inside when I was ready. I checked Instagram, an impulse, and saw a tornado had touched down 20 minutes away while I was outside. At first, I was shocked, but then deeply satisfied that I, like the birds and the trees, had stayed present in the moment, living for the feeling of breeze on our limbs and raindrops on our heads, and no worry over anything but our corner of the world. If you're new here, welcome. This is the spot where an ad break would usually go. Instead, I like to give you a minute to take a deep breath and listen to some peaceful nature sounds. I'd like to say that I'm taking a stand against corporate America, but really, I just don't have any sponsors. So, enjoy! When I was little, I would only eat beige foods. My palate was completely monochromatic. I'm not even kidding. Chicken nuggets, vanilla yogurt, French fries, ranch dressing, milk. No ketchup, even on hot dogs. My only exception was fruit. I was a big fan of strawberries. Given my aversion to colored foods, Italian restaurants were my jam. Fettuccine Alfredo and all the buttered bread I could wish for. Macaroni Girls paper-covered tables that we'd play hangman on with fat, off-brand crayons were my first introduction to pasta. As my horizons expanded gastronomically, pasta was always a staple in our house. Not that what we were eating was mind-blowing, but my parents did have their own idea of what pasta should be like, having lived in Italy for several years when my dad was in the Navy. Pasta came out of a blue box, Barilla or bust. It was always cooked al dente, to the tooth. No mushy spaghetti in sight. While we never made our own sauce, my mom wouldn't go near the sugar-filled ragu or prego. We'd stock up on a boutique brand marinara at the natural grocery store. And the sauce was always, always, always mixed with the pasta, never served on top. I remember one of the first meals I ever ate at my husband's family's house, and I was horrified when his parents served up a pile of stuck-together spaghetti with the sauce in the pot on the side. They made up for it, though, by serving rice made in a rice cooker. Magic to my white bread world, on the side. Pasta was always a strong contender for my favorite food growing up, occasionally usurped by Cracker Barrel's hash brown casserole, or black olives, or, when summer hit, corn on the cob. It makes me laugh now, knowing that back then I never really understood what pasta could be. Fast forward 20 years and I make homemade pasta pretty much weekly. Semolina and water kneaded and shaped into little twists of trofiei or cups of cavatelle. Egg dough fed through my shiny silver marchetto, rolled into thin sheets destined for ravioli or pappardelle. My sauces start from scratch these days, too. Sun-ripe tomatoes and garlic, verdant green basil and olive oil, an entire bottle of red wine, staining the strands a deep plum. Don't get me wrong, those nostalgic blue boxes still have a place in my pantry, but they're reserved for emergency, don't feel like cooking cacio e pepe. Pasta is still my favorite food after all these years. When I look at the person I am today and how she's different from the person I was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, some of the things that stand out are brand new. Practicing yoga, reading nonfiction, wearing hats, voting blue. But the things I find more interesting about the current version of me are the things that on the surface are new, but if you dig deep, they're really just old things, evolved as I've grown. Pasta is one of those things. Every shape I roll out now, though my process is just a year old, is tied to those first bowls of fettuccine Alfredo, countless dinners of refrigerator surprise, anchored by penne, and eaten on a faded quilt in front of Princess Diaries on the TV. When we landed in Rome, I'm not sure my sister and I had really slept at all on the 14-hour flight. My stepmom was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed from an Advil PM and a business class upgrade, but we drank our first cappuccinos in the hotel lobby and headed out to explore the ancient city in the mid-morning sunshine, delirious. We ended up, many hours later, at a patio table in a piazza, walking distance from the Pantheon, an old Italian man playing Frank Sinatra on an accordion, eating pasta. To tell you the truth, my punch-drunk mind didn't hold on to exactly what the dish was, other than that it was absolutely transformative. The entire evening has this sparkly quality to it, half from being awake for 36 straight hours, and half from it finally clicking. I'd been reading the pages of Bon Appetit magazine from age 10, experimenting in the kitchen once a week when my mom would let me, so I had this idea that maybe food could be more than boxed pasta and dinner out at Chili's. But I think that trip to Italy at 18 was one of the first times I really understood. We got hopelessly lost trying to find our restaurant in Florence, but when we finally sat down, I have such a vivid memory of the linguine with clams put in front of me, covered in pepper. I was wearing a pink sundress with white polka dots, my legs covered in mysterious and huge welts, ostensibly from some sort of spider living in our 18th century villa. Perhaps the most transformative meal from that trip was pesto gnocchi, eaten on the most perfect patio under an immense tree, where my dad spontaneously proposed to my stepmom, using a ring shaped like a squirrel my sister and I had bought at Claire's, one of its emerald-colored rhinestone eyes already missing. Fettuccine Alfredo on paper-covered tables, bowls of boxed pasta with jarred marinara, gnocchi on a Tuscan patio, pots of pasta cooked from the pages of Bon Appetit, a splurge I allowed myself when I couldn't even afford internet at my studio apartment, where the fire alarm would go off if the water boiled too vigorously. Date nights at a little Italian restaurant with vinyl booths, where the waiters would always give us free alcohol as teenagers. Bowls and bowls of pasta cooked on the camp stove out of the back of our Subaru all across the West. The first meal I ever spent three digits on during a fall evening in Aspen, the trees glowing in the gathering dusk. Vodka penne made accidentally with pear vodka out of Forest Service bowls in a fire lookout during a lightning storm. An invisible string. Last fall, shortly after I'd begun to hand-make pasta, we went on a trip to Fruta out in western Colorado with the sole purpose of trying out mountain biking. We rented really nice bikes from a shop in town and followed the bike shop's directions to a popular beginner's trailhead. I'd only recently gotten back on a bike, but as we climbed what then felt like an impossibly steep hill, followed by 5 miles of flowy single track, peppered with slick rock, my muscle memory took over, and I was hooked. As we drove home, buzzing about our newfound love, already researching bikes, I could clearly see the look on 12-year-old me's face. Total shock. While my orange Kona hardtail and the newfound blue-black trails we've been riding feel totally new, like the bowl of pasta I'll make when I get back home, I know there was evolution to get here. Learning to ride a two-wheeler and crashing into our neighbor's parked car. Riding in infinite half-moons around the cul-de-sac across the street and two doors down, pretending our bikes were horses. Mine was a Palomino named Dakota Star. Another evolution. There's now a sweet, giant-footed Rocky Mountain horse in the second stall at my parents' ranch named Dakota. Riding our bikes as teenagers down the hill to our friend's house, pushing them back up at the end of the night because we didn't do hills. Debating whether my hatred for bike riding or my hatred of public transportation was higher each day in Boulder when it was time to go to class. When my chain fell off my bike, I was relegated to the latter. Invisible strings. I have a dozen more stories of evolution. Being persuaded to hike another 100 steps for a singular gummy snack, to training to climb Kilimanjaro. Skiing a wobbly pizza attached to leashes between my dad's legs, to skiing double black diamonds. Writing stories on printer paper and binding them with staples, to seeing my byline in a magazine at Sprouts. John Muir said, "When we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe." Making pasta is a simple thing, but when you examine its threads, it becomes extraordinary. When I think of every gnarled hand that kept these shapes alive, when I think of every person who brought their grandmother's recipes with them to America, when I think of every drop of rain, every breeze, every ray of sunlight that grew the semolina, when I think of every place this 225 grams of warm water has been, when I think of every bite of pasta that's led me to this point in my life right now, I realize it really is hitched to everything else in the universe. Extraordinary.
If you like Sea Salt and Parm, please rate, subscribe, share, and all those things professional podcasters ask you to do. You can find me on Instagram @TheMillennialOutside and then @SeaSaltAndParm for podcast updates.